ಮಗ್ನಸ್ತುಪ್ಯಮಾನಭರಂ ತಪಃ ನಿರ್ವೃತಾಂ ಮೀನರಾಜಸ್ಯ ದೃಷ್ಟ್ವಾ ಮೈಥುನ ಧಾರ್ಮಿಣಃ ಜಾತಸ್ಪರಿ ಹೋ ನಿರ್ನಾಮ್ ವಿಪ್ರಾ ಕನ್ಯಾಂ ಏಕಾಂ ಅಯಾಚತ ಸೋಪ್ಯಾಹಾ ಗೃಹಯಥಾಂ ಭ್ರಮನ್ ಕಾಮನ್ ಕನ್ಯಾ ಸ್ವಯಂ ವರೇ. Sobari Rishi was engaged in austerity deep in the waters of the river Jamuna. When he saw a pair of fish engaged in sexual affairs, thus he perceived the pleasure of sex life, and induced by this desire, he went to King Mandhata and begged for one of the king's daughters. In response to this request, the king said, "O Brahman, any of my daughters may accept any husband according to her personal selection." Purport by Srila Prabhupada. This is the beginning of the story of Sobari Rishi. According to Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur, Mandhata was the king of Mathura, and Sobari Rishi was engaged in austerity while submerged deep within the river Jamuna. When the Rishi felt sexual desire, he emerged from the water and went to King Mandhata to ask that one of his daughters becomes his wife. Sadhayishye tathatmanam surastrinam abhipshitam Kim punar manujendranam iti vyavashita prabhu. Sobari Muni thought, "I am now feeble because of old age. My hair has become gray, my skin is slack, and my head always trembles. Besides, I am a yogi, therefore women do not like me. Since the king has thus rejected me, I shall reform my body in such a way as to be desirable even to celestial women, to speak of the daughters of worldly kings." Muni praveshita kshatra kanyanta puram harditam ardhimat vrittasa rajakanya bhir ekam panchasatavara. Thereafter, when Sobari Muni became quite a young and beautiful person, the messenger of the palace took him inside the residential quarters of the princesses, which were extremely opulent. All 50 princesses then accepted him as their husband, although he was only one man. Hasam kalira budbhuyam stharate bhoyaso hridam mamanurupo nayam va iti tadgata chetisam. Thereafter, the princesses, being attracted by Sobari Muni, gave up their sisterly relationship and quarreled among themselves, each one of them contending, "This man is just suitable for me and not for you." In this way, there ensued a great disagreement. Sabhavrachasthabir aparaniya tapasriya nagriya parichadesu riheshu nano pavanamalabha sarasu sogandika kananeshu. Because Sobari Muni was expert in chanting mantras perfectly, his severe austerities resulted in an opulent home with garments, ornaments, properly dressed and decorated maidservants and manservants, and varieties of parks with clear water lakes and gardens. In the gardens, fragrant with varieties of flowers, birds chirped and bees hummed, surrounded by professional singers. Sobari Muni's home was amply provided with valuable beds, seats, ornaments, and arrangements for bathing, and there were varieties of sandalwood creams, flower garlands, and palatable dishes. Thus surrounded by opulent paraphernalia, the Muni engaged in family affairs with his numerous wives. Report by Srila Prabhupada. Sobari Rishi was a great yogi. Yogic perfection makes available 8 material opulences: anima, lagima, mahima, prapti, prakamya, ishitva, vishitva, and kamavashayita. Sobhari Muni exhibited super excellence in material enjoyment by dint of his yogic perfection. The word bhavricha means expert in chanting mantras. As material opulence can be achieved by ordinary material means, it can also be achieved by subtle means through mantras. By chanting mantras, Sobhari Muni arranged for material opulence, but this was not perfection in life. As will be seen, Sobhari Muni became very dissatisfied with material opulence and thus left everything and re-entered the forest in the Vanaprastha order and achieved final success. Those who are not Atmatattva-vit do not know the spiritual value of life can be satisfied with external material opulences. But those who are Atmatattva-vit are not inspired by material opulence. This is the instruction we can derive from the life and activities of Sobhari Muni. This is a very wonderful narration by Srila Shukadeva Goswami. This chapter is entitled The Downfall of Sobhari Muni. And there is a great lesson to be learned by this narration. Sobhari Muni was a great, great yogi. Throughout all the universe, his powers, due to his very, very severe austerity, were well known. Sobhari Muni was able to perform miracles that are very difficult to comprehend. You see, in the Ashtanga yoga system, it is a mechanical process by which controlling our senses, controlling our prana or life air, we can gain control over the subtle powers of this material creation. And we can perform wonderful activities that are impossible for an ordinary man. Sobhari Muni had the power to meditate for years and years together on the bottom of a river. Of course, it is explained in Bhagavad Gita that if we want to find a suitable place for meditation, it should be absolutely quiet and free from disturbance. So in this world, especially in the age of Kali Yuga, there are so many disturbances. We have seen, even if you go high, high into the Himalayas, looking for perfect peace and quiet, trying to get away from all technology and modern life, every now and then jet airplanes come roaring by. And you look up and realize that there's practically nowhere you can go today where there are not the disturbances of modern technology. But Sobhari Muni, of course, this is in a previous age, in order to find absolute immunity from all human life and all their complications, he decided to go where no human being can go, to the bottom of the river, where it is absolutely quiet and free from any disturbances. And there he sat in meditation. You may ask, this is impossible. How is it that he could breathe at the bottom of a river? If it were me, I would be drowned to death. But how is it that a fish can live in the bottom of the river? A fish is also breathing. He is receiving oxygen from the water. And he lives his whole life very peacefully. So you see, it is not that it is impossible. It is impossible for us, but it is possible for someone else. But at the same time, for a fish to live outside of water like we do, he is thinking, how is it possible? It's inconceivable. A fish is thinking, how can anyone live without water? How can anyone live outside? They must die immediately. So according to their relative perception, what is possible is absolutely opposite of what is possible according to our conception. It is described in the Shastra that there are also living beings living on the sun planet. In fact, in the kingdom of Surya, there is a great, great civilization. It is a heavenly planet. Great yogis and sages, they do severe penances and tapasya for long, long periods of time to attain entrance into the sun planet. Now, as far as you are concerned, or me, if we were to go anywhere near the sun planet, if we were to be even a few degrees closer to the sun planet, we would be burned to ashes. And besides that, when we look at the sun, we do not see any civilization. But you see, in this world, there are different type of bodies which are specifically suitable for different environments. If you have there are five elements on the gross level of consciousness. Earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And according to which of these elements is prominent, according to the combination, then that particular body is able to live in a particular atmosphere. It is very relative. The grossest element is earth. And I'm sorry to tell you, but we have the grossest bodies. Our bodies are very prominently earthly. And therefore, we can live very comfortably on the earth. But those who have subtler bodies, which have more prominence of water, they cannot live on the earth. But they live very comfortably in the water, where we cannot live. And those who have even subtler material bodies, bodies of fire, they can live in an atmosphere of fire. And they can build their cities, their countrysides. They can have a perfect livelihood within fire, like in the sun planet. And there is also bodies of air and bodies which are most prominently made of space or ether. It is said one man's food is another man's poison. So we should not be so foolish and so egocentric to think who I am and what I can do is applicable to everyone. Just like the scientists, by their research of the other planets within our solar system, according to the temperature, according to the atmosphere that they have studied, they have decided that life can exist on this planet. Life cannot exist on the planets too far because it is too cold, too far from sun. Cannot exist too close to the sun. At the most, life can possibly exist on the planet that's nearest to ours. But then it would only be something like vegetation or like that. This is the false ego of the scientists. They are trying to calculate everything possible and impossible by what we can do. For an insignificant ant crawling on the ground, he is thinking that for me to pick up this leaf
is very difficult. But for my father, he could do it. But to pick up this table, for the ant, this table, is equivalent to our picking up a mountain. It's impossible. No ant in all of creation, no one can pick up this table. In fact, they do not think that you can or we can. They are only concerned with what is possible for an ant. Therefore, who can pick up this table? Impossible. But because we have a different type of body, by the laws of material nature, even a small child can pick up this table. But then again, we have consciousness like ant. When we look at a mountain, we say, how can anyone pick up this mountain? It is impossible. It is too big. I cannot do it. My friends cannot do it. But we find Hanumanji, the son of Vayu, because of his divine birth, he had such power that he was able to effortlessly pick up mountains. Not only pick up mountains, but he could fly in the sky with that mountain, balancing in his hand. It is not difficult. And the demigods in the heavens, they are so powerful, we have difficulty just controlling the lights within our own temple. I was telling Radha Krishna, why is it that these lights, we cannot keep them going on? Every time we turn, half of them are out. Such a sophisticated temple with such aristocratic people coming, and we cannot even make the lights work. He said, it's not possible. We've tried everything. It's possible. So here we are. We cannot even control the lights in a small temple. But then we find here is Suryadev. He is controlling the entire sun. Vayu is controlling the wind throughout the entire universe. When there is a tornado, even the most powerful amongst men, the only thing he can do is hide underground. So this is the difference. We are like ants. What is possible for us and what is impossible for others, this is all relative. But the mystic yogis, by their great, great achievements through the process of controlling the energies within their own body and within their own mind, they are able to enter into various realms of material consciousness that are inconceivable to us. Therefore, Sobari Muni effortlessly was living like a fish underwater, although he had a human birth. So we may think, this is very great. I cannot do this. But something very interesting took place. While he was underwater, he happened to see fish enjoying the pleasures of sexual union. So, this awakened deeply in his own heart the desire to enjoy like this. So he decided, what is the use of me being down here underwater? There's no one for me to enjoy sex life with. The fish are better than me. They are more happy. So he came out of the water in order to find a nice bride. But he wanted the most beautiful, beautiful young lady to be his, to enjoy. So he approached the kingdom of Maharaj Mandata, who was then the emperor of Mathura, who had 50 daughters. And of course, Sobari Muni, he was very old. And besides that, You know what it's like when you live underwater for so many years? You become very disfigured from our own calculations. So he told King Mandata that I want to marry one of your daughters. And the king was very afraid that if he were to say anything to offend this great yogi, he would be cursed. Because if you displease these great yogis, who cannot control their senses, who cannot control their minds, although they control practically everything else, there could be great trouble within one's life. So he's decided that I will be very, very diplomatic. Yes, my daughters, they can choose whichever husband they want, knowing that none of them would choose such an old and ugly man as Sobhari Muni. It is considered a great curse for a young, beautiful woman to be married to an old and ugly man. Just like when Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to go to the bank of the Ganges. The young ladies who were unmarried, they would go to the Ganga to worship Goddess Durga for a nice, rich, handsome, young husband. And they would start to make all sorts of nice offerings and preparations for Lord Shankar and his consort. And Nimai Pandit, he was just a young boy at the time. He would jump onto their little altar and he would eat all the offerings. And he would just take the garlands and put it on his own necks. And he would take the sandalwood and put it on his own head. And he would sit there and they would say, "What have you done? You have spoiled our offering." And Nimai Pandit said, "No, I am the Lord of Shankar. I am the Lord of Durga. All these offerings are meant for me alone." And they would, some of them would enjoy it very much because he was very charming and very beautiful. But others, they were thinking, "What a horrible offense. He has taken the offering meant for Lord Shiva. This is terrible." And he would run away. And he would bring great fear into their lives. He would say, "If you don't come back and give me all the rest of your offerings, then as a Brahmin, I threaten to curse you that you will have an old and ugly husband with many co-wives." And some of them were thinking, "My God, maybe his curse will come true." And they would come back and offer him all devotion. So this is the tendency of women. They want nice young husbands who can give them nice children. So Mandata Maharaj knew this. Nobody will take this old yogi. But Sobhari Muni, he was very, very attentive to fulfill his desires. Therefore, he disappeared from the scene for some time, and with his great, great mystic power, although he was old, old man, and it is described here, his hair was gray and falling out, and his skin was very loose and wrinkled. He transformed his body to be youthful and beautiful and effulgent so that any woman would be attracted. Now, this is something we cannot do. Even the great, great wealthy people of this world, when they start growing old, they have all types of operations that cost so much money just to try to tighten their skin. And they spend huge sums of their money to buy various cosmetic creams to try to bring about some moisture, some promised advertisements are always explaining that you can be young again. You do not need to have gray hairs. You do not need to have wrinkles in your skin. And if you can't fix it, then you try to cover it by buying powders to fill in the cracks and just make it appear that you're still young. But ultimately, we do not have the power to reverse
the force of time, which is gradually causing us to dwindle into old age, disease, and death. This is a great frustration for people who are attached to sense enjoyment, that they want to enjoy like a young person, but nobody wants to enjoy with them. Just like Srila Prabhupada used to laugh so hard when he would see. He would laugh, but he would laugh in a sense of great compassion. Because he would see how in Britain and in America, these dancing clubs, they are called discos, where people go to find young ladies and dance and drink and smoke and have all fun. He would hear that men 75, 80 years old were going to these places to try to enjoy. And he would see with his own eyes people going to these places. Just see. This desire for sense enjoyment never leaves one. Srila Prabhupada explains the story of this one very, very wealthy king. What was the story? This king had a minister. And the minister was trying to convince him to accept spiritual life. But the king said, I'm very young still, and I still have so much desire to enjoy the material world, enjoy my senses. When I become old, then I will lose my desire for all these material things, and then I will take to spiritual life. It will become very easy. But now, I have too much passion, so let me enjoy. So the minister of this king was very wise. He said, you have a young daughter, do you not? He said, yes. Bring her. So they went to a home where a very, very old, old, old man was on his deathbed. He was minutes away from the demise of his body. He was suffering, horrible. And the king and his daughter came into the room. And here it is, the king. This is an ordinary man. You would think he would offer his obeisances to the king nicely. So out of formality, he folded his hands and said namaste to the king. But his eyes were completely fixed on the young, beautiful daughter of the king. And the whole time in the room, this young man was simply looking at the daughter, thinking, how I wish I could enjoy. It was obvious. So the king saw this and he was shocked. He was thinking, my God, even such a person in such old age and debility, he's still thinking of sense enjoyment. So the solution to my problem is not to get old. The minister said, yes. Your desire for sense enjoyment will remain in every stage of life. It is only through purification of the heart that you can give it up. So the king became very serious about spiritual life and renunciation at that point in his life. So here we have Sobari Muni. He performed such tapasya. He fasted and restrained his senses for so many years and years. He was obviously also a great scholar of Vedanta, Vedas. Otherwise, how would he know these processes? And therefore, because of his great, great, great achievements in the process of yoga and gyan, he was able to live underwater, which we cannot do. He was able to change the form of his body from old age to youth, which we cannot do. But despite all this, he still had insatiable desires to enjoy apart from God. And in the end, all the great, great gifts that were given to him by his austerity He used it all simply to enjoy his senses. What a shame. We see like someone like Lord Jesus Christ, he had mystic powers, he could perform miracles, but he did not use any of them for his sense enjoyment. He used them to heal others, to raise the dead, to heal the lepers, to exorcise ghosts. These are material benedictions he was giving, but at least they were humanitarian. And using these things as a springboard, he was trying to raise people to a higher consciousness of faith in God and love for God. Why? Because Lord Jesus Christ was a devotee. He was a bhakta. Therefore, whatever he had, he used in God's service. But here we find Sobari Muni. He was not like that. Because he was not a bhakta, ultimately he was using all of the great, great powers and gifts that God has given him simply for his own sense enjoyment. Can you imagine the good he could have done for the world with what he could do? But what did he use it for? To get some women to enjoy for himself. Such a waste. Whatever we have, it is meant for Krishna's pleasure. Whether it is money, whether it is intelligence, whether it is mystic power, they are all material. It is all meant for Krishna's pleasure. But unless we awaken devotion in our hearts, it is just a matter of time till we use all these things for our own purposes. This is a very great danger. Even in the Hare Krishna movement, this is very great danger. When the Hare Krishna movement began, Prabhupada had nothing. He had absolutely nothing. All he had when he got off that boat in New York City, he was 70 years old. He had no friends, he had no contacts in New York whatsoever. He just had a few books. What to do with books? And they were Indian books. Indian books means they're not very popular in America. The binding comes out. Printing is not very good. The language is not very readable to those who are English speaking. That's all he had. He was living in the ghettos of New York City, in the Bowery, in poverty. Didn't know where he was going to live, what he was going to eat from one day to the next. And after a few years, because of Krishna's great pleasure in his tapasya and his devotion, soon he had over 100 temples. And he had thousands and thousands and thousands of disciples who were willing to give him anything and everything at any moment. His flying, he went to India, it took over 1 month on a Jaladuta. It was not a passenger ship. It was a cargo ship, which is not even fit for humans to travel on. It's meant to move big, big material goods. Nobody travels on these ships. It's not a smooth ride. There's no conveniences. But soon he was flying in jet airplanes. Traveling, circling the world 12 times in a few years. And wherever he would come, when he arrived on the Jaladuta in Boston Harbor, New York City, he just looked around. There was no one to greet him, no one. He was alone. He didn't know where to go, what to do. But now he would get off the plane and there would be hundreds and hundreds of devotees having kirtan with beautiful garlands, wonderful prasad. They would rent limousines from the airport. They would escort him to a beautiful temple where they had the most wonderful, wonderful facilities for him to live. I remember in Los Angeles, where he would spend much time, they bought a beautiful church big, big church, and his quarters, there were chandeliers and beautiful drapes and wonderful carpets and beautiful pictures painted by the devotees with love. They would bring him so much nice prasad. But despite all this, Srila Prabhupada always remained the same. In his heart, he was never different than he was when he came off that Jaladuta. Because he understood nothing here is mine. Nothing is for my pleasure. It is all for Krishna. Krishna is the supreme enjoyer. He was experiencing the ultimate happiness of serving Krishna. Param drisvani vartate. The sweet pleasure of bhakti is so delightful, so wonderful, that the thought of enjoying separate from Krishna is a horrible thought. It doesn't even cross the mind of somebody who's enwrapped in the ecstasy of bhakti. So although he had all of this, never once did he consider, this is mine, I will enjoy. He always remained very simple. He always remained perfectly pure. He always remained like a lotus flower, aloof from the dirt and filth of the pond that he was in the association of. This is bhakti. But if one is not experiencing the higher tastes of bhakti, then these material benedictions that come, they very much enamor the mind. The original disciples of Srila Prabhupada, they were very, very austere because, like Prabhupada, they had nothing. They were sleeping in very, very primitive conditions, no heat in the winter, sometimes no water. Very simple, crowded. They would have to go outside and endure all sorts of persecutions. But they were so enthusiastic because they simply wanted to please their guru. They didn't care anything for themselves. But then what happened is a fruit of their great austerities, several things take place. One is you make spiritual advancement if you pass the tests. But sometimes the tests are that Krishna gives you all sorts of nice, luxurious surroundings to enjoy. Oh, yes. You have been such a nice devotee when you had nothing. Now you have everything. Now will you be just as simple and renounced? And what happened is soon some of those same people, now I have a nice car. Now I have a nice house. Now I'm president and everything's in order and we have a big, beautiful temple. And they just began to enjoy nice prasad. There's no need for all these austerities. That's for when you don't have anything. Now we have everything. And their preaching became less, their service became less. They thought, we're successful, look, we have all this for Krishna. But was it really for Krishna? Or was it for them? Srila Prabhupada had all these conveniences, but he never stayed anywhere. He was always traveling here, there, everywhere, performing great austerities. He was never attached to enjoying anything, anywhere. So this is a great danger, very great danger, that we become comfortable. And what Krishna gives us, we use for our enjoyment. It is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first canto, that when one performs devotional service, the gifts, the benedictions that Krishna gives you by the performance of your devotional service, you should never think they are meant for your enjoyment. There for Krishna. Bhoktaram Jagatapasam. He is the enjoyer of all our sacrifices. All the fruits of our sacrifices are meant for his pleasure. So this is a very great lesson. That being a mystic yogi who could perform all these mystical tricks is not a very great thing. But being a humble bhakta, who simply wants to do everything for the pleasure of Krishna, this is the supreme great attainment of life. This is the highest position. Sometimes we recall how Mystic Yogi came to Prabhupada and began to perform all nice miracles. And everybody around, including Prabhupada's own disciples, were thinking, my God, this person can actually perform miracles. He's a very great person. And they were just, they were very impressed. Prabhupada just looked at him with just a disdain in his mouth and just said, why don't you give up all this nonsense and surrender to Krishna? Prabhupada never performed these tricks. He didn't care for performing these tricks. One who actually understands spirituality and truth, he adores someone who has the quality of humble devotion. Someone who has the quality by which they sacrifice for the pleasure of God. The supreme wealth is bhakti, devotion, love. Because it is only by that love that we become disinterested in material enjoyment, which is ultimately the cause of pain. And we will find in the life of Sobari Muni that he uses what had taken him births and births and births and births to attain this mystic power. He used it all just to enjoy material life. He was living in the bottom of the Jamuna River. What opulences are there from the material point of view? And by his great austerity, he was living in the beautiful palace of King Mandata. Marble, gold, jewelry, finest foods, and he had the most lovely, beautiful wives, 50 of them, who were constantly engaged in his service with faithfulness. They were chaste. Everything a man could want in a woman, he had 50 of them. And they simply were there for his enjoyment only. They were living only for his enjoyment. How much he was happy with the material pleasures of life. But although he had all these things, he was still frustrated. He still wanted more. He realized in material life, the more you want to enjoy, the more you try to get to enjoy, and the more you try to get to enjoy, the more it only increases the fire of desire to enjoy. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, kama is like a fire. The more fuel you put on a fire, the hungrier and more devouring it becomes. This is the nature of this world. But yet we are thinking, if only I have a little more, then I'll be satisfied. But when you get a little more, then what is the result? If only I had a lot more, then I would be satisfied. And then when you get a lot more, then you think, if only I had this much more, then I will be satisfied. And all your precious human energy is wasted simply chasing after the mirage of material promises for happiness. In a mirage, you're thinking, oh, it's right here, the water. I'm so thirsty. I cannot bear this thirst. The water's right here. I can see it. It's right before me. And then when you get there, you realize it's just a little further ahead. And it's a little further ahead. And it's a little further ahead. And you're running, 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 running until finally you drop dead and you never find it. So enjoyment is always a little ahead. We get a little taste and we're thinking, ah, but that taste is soon consumed. With a little more, a little more, a little further, a little more time, a little more energy, then I will achieve my desired goal in life. But it is the promise of Maya that you will enjoy. But it is her ways that you will never find pleasure, real pleasure. The more you get, the more you want. Subari Muni had everything a person could possibly want, and he went through incredible processes to achieve it. And still, for some time he was illusioned by this pleasure. For some time he was intoxicated by everything around him. But soon it wears thin, and then he realized that this is miserable. I was better off sitting on the bank of the river. I was better off under the water with nothing and no one.
Now I have this young, young, beautiful body. I was better off an old, diseased man.
So ultimately he gave it up. Ultimately we all have to give it up.
This is the difference between the mystic yogic process and devotional service.
Whatever we have is meant for Krishna.
Do not be like Subari Muni and use the gifts that God gives us for our own selfish purposes.
Ultimately, it will only frustrate us.
Real joy, real happiness comes through the supreme sacrifice, the supreme yoga of bhakti.
That I am your devotee, Krishna. I am your servant.
How may I serve you? This is the only aspiration for those who truly understand the conclusion of the Vedas.
Krishna, how can I serve you?
Srila Prabhupada used to tell us that all the different knowledge of the Vedas, all the great deep philosophy, they are all meant to bring us to one conclusion. They are all meant to bring us to one conclusion, to ask one question. Krishna, how can I serve you? How can I please you? Atapum beard vijastres das varna shrama vibhaka shashvanushtatasya dharmasya samsudir hari toshana.
Whatever your field of life may be, whether you are a mystic yogi, whether you are a housewife, whether you are a student,
whether you are a businessman in the city, or whether you are a farmer in the country, or whether you are a sannyasi in the jungles, the perfection of your life is simply to perform your activities for the pleasure of Krishna, in the service of Krishna, without any desire for my own personal interests.
So let us strive for this and this alone.
Hare Krishna.
Is there any questions?
Yes.
Seeing the case of Subari Muni, I think in spiritual life also there is a danger at every step.
Yes, but try to understand this, my friend.
What is the greatest danger? What is the supreme topmost of all dangers? Do you know? To commit offense to a devotee. There's nothing more dangerous than that. Do everything else, it's not as bad. But if you commit offense to a devotee, you lose everything.
Subari Muni was such a great mystic yogi. He had such powers. Do you know why he fell down?
You see, if you're protected by Krishna, you do not fall down. Even if you do, you come right back up. Huh?
But Subari Muni,
he offended Garuda. And because of this, Krishna took away all his protection and all of his intelligence.
Subari Muni, it is described that he was living on bank of Jamuna for some time, and he became very friendly with all the fish. And Garuda, he is a bird by physical nature, and therefore he likes to eat the fish. It is his quota to eat fish. Everyone is allowed to live by quota.
So Subari Muni, he made a pack with these fish to protect them.
So he said, Garuda, do not eat these fish. So right then and there, Garuda just picked up fish. So Subari Muni became very angry, not knowing that Garuda was a very great devotee of the Lord. He cursed him. He said, you rascal, you cannot control your senses. If you ever come back to this lake again, you will die. He underestimated the greatness of a great devotee. He did not understand the inconceivable nature of this devotee. He appeared like an ordinary bird, but he was not. Similarly, if you take a great devotee to be ordinary, the tendency is you commit offenses, you treat him ordinary. And that is the greatest mistake you can make. Learn from Subhari Muni. He was such a self-controlled yogi. Now, you and me, if you were to see two fish having sexual pleasure, would you be disturbed? Huh? Not at all. You would just walk by and say, fish. It's the way fish live. Right here in Bombay, we're sitting right in the Brahmacharya ashram and crows come by and start having sex right in front of us. Does it disturb your mind? You just walk by. Rats, they're having sex. And just insects are going around having sex life going on all over the place. It doesn't disturb you when you see these lower creatures. You don't even think about it. And you're not such a great yogi. I'm not such a great yogi. Even the ordinary man in the streets are not disturbed about these things. So Bari Muni, who was such a great yogi, he was restraining his senses from every type of pleasure possible for so many thousands of years. How is it that such a great person as this, such a tapasi, is so much intoxicated by seeing two little fish? Why? Because he offended a devotee, Krishna took away all his intelligence, took away all his ability to control his senses. It didn't happen immediately. This is sometime later. The fruits of whatever we do must ripen sooner or later. The fruits of our devotional service will ripen sooner or later as love of God. The fruits of our tapasya will ripen as power, with power. The fruits of our studies will ripen with knowledge. The fruits of our offenses will ultimately, in due course of time, ripen with our fall down, where our intelligence is bewildered by Krishna himself. So Subhari Muni fell down for one reason and one reason alone, because he committed an offense to a great soul. Krishna took away his intelligence. If you could simply avoid this one thing, offending great souls, Krishna will protect you, as long as you're striving sincerely on the path of bhakti. It is the mad elephant offense. All our good qualities are taken away. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, we read the story of a great sannyasi, Ramchandrapuri. He offended his guru, and because of that, he lost all his good qualities. He was still a sannyasi, but he was simply envious, fault-finding, and critical of everyone. He can't make any spiritual advancement in that condition of life. So therefore, we should be very sincere. And we should not strive for any material powers like Subhari Muni, knowing that these things, ultimately, they're all material. One German scientist came to India, and he met so many great mystic yogis. He was at first impressed, but then after a while he thought, so what? Alas, he met Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He said, I have seen yogis walking over water, but then I was thinking that in the West we have boats that can take us across water. I mean, what is the big difference? Whether you go by boat or whether you walk, you get across the water. I have seen yogis fly in the sky. So what? We have airplanes that fly in the sky and helicopters. It might be faster, like him, but it's basically the same thing, getting from one place to the airways. I have seen yogis produce gold, but I can go to the store and buy the same gold. So all these great yogis, I have found that through modern technology, we have achieved basically the same. He says, but there's something you have that none of these other yogis have. Something you have that you cannot find through any science, technology, or any store in the world. You have love. You have devotion. You have humility. This is what I want. I want to be your disciple.
Huh? So we should understand that the true wealth, the true goal of life is this and this alone. We should not ever allow our minds to be diverted to the phantasmagoria, the glittering pleasures of this world. And at the same time, although striving for this by accepting the instructions of the great souls, Guru and Sadhu and Shastra, we must very, very carefully avoid committing offenses to those who are dear and near to Krishna. Knowing by that process, we can instantly lose everything. And therefore, we understand who the great devotees are. Rupa Goswami says, you can understand the great soul because their tendency to find faults has disappeared in their life. This is one of the essential qualities we must look for. That tendency to find fault and criticize others is no longer there. The tendency to see the good and to love others becomes more and more prominent as we make spiritual advancement. Does that answer your question? Thank you very much. Yes. It's a test. Sometimes Krishna says, Yasya hamanagrinami harishita dhanam shanai. When I show my compassion to my devotee, I give him whatever he wants and needs. But when I show my supreme compassion, I take everything away. So that he has nowhere else to turn except me. Huh? So eventually he will take everything away if you misuse. And then you have to learn the hard way. But part of the process of purification is you must be tested. You are doing this for me? You are promising this for me? Okay, I give it to you. But then the tendency is once you have it, you think, oh, I have earned this. This is mine. Huh? That is the test. And in that test, we have the choice to utilize our independence according to the humble direction of the Guru or according to our own desires. So we require going through these tests in order to make spiritual advancement. If we pass the test, we very rapidly and quickly are on the path back to Godhead. If we fail the test, you should understand that's part of the process of learning. In other words, some people have to go through failing tests and suffer to give up certain desires that they're clinging to within their hearts. So in either way, it's perfect. If Krishna gives you and you misuse it, it's perfect. Because through this, it's a long process back to Godhead. But it is the process of going back to Godhead. You're taking a detour. You're wasting all this time, but ultimately you're going to get burnt. And ultimately, that burning is going to burn the tendency for material enjoyment out of your heart. And you're going to come crawling back to Krishna and say, I'm sorry, please let me have another chance. Some people have to go through that. Huh? But those who are intelligent do not go through that. Those who are intelligent, they adhere very strictly to the guidance of Guru. They do not act independently. They are on the straight and direct road back home, back to Godhead. So in either case, Krishna knows what we need. Huh? If a devotee falls down, we should not think, we may not follow in their footsteps, we may not follow in their instructions, but we should not criticize them. Because they're going through the purification that they require. They're on their way back to Godhead. They're on the road, but they're taking detour. They have to go through many years, perhaps many lives,
of living in an illusion to realize the emptiness of that illusion. But this is part of what they require to bring him to that higher state of Krishna consciousness. But we should not be so foolish to go through that indirect process. We should simply be humble devotees and follow the instructions. Then in this life, it is guaranteed you will see Krishna. Hare Krishna.